Hi, I'm Mac.
Hi, I'm Abigail.
And this is Unsubs.
This is the podcast where we recap, rate, and review all 324 episodes of Criminal Minds. And today, we're talking the Eye episode. Season 5, Episode 6, The Eyes Have It. Should I share my fun fact?
Yes.
My fun fact is I just got an Instapot. I won't say bullied into it by the ladies at my job, but they were like, oh, you have to have one. So I was like, okay, I guess I gotta have one. So I did do the little trial run where you like put water in it and steam it and everything. And I'm going to be actually cooking with it tonight. So we'll see how that turns out.
That's so exciting.
It's a little intimidating and a little scary because they're like, do not open the lid without releasing the pressure. And I'm like, I'm going to die. What's your fun fact?
Nothing of interest that I'm comfortable sharing has happened recently.
Here's another fun fact from me. I finally fucking watched Speed. Wait, what is it called?
Oh, Spree? You watched Spree!
I watched Spree, yes, not Speed. Speed is the iconic Keanu Reeves movie, which I've also seen. No, I fucking watched Spree.
Thoughts on Spree?
I'm so attracted to him. What's his name?
Joe Keery.
Oh my god, I'm so attracted to him in that movie, and I did love it. 10 out of 10. Also makes me terrified to ever accept water from anyone in a bottle.
Oh my god, it's such a good movie. Everyone should go watch Spree if they haven't yet.
Can I share the rating criteria?
Please do.
So we rate each episode on a scale of 0 to 100, and we have 5 different categories that we consider. So each category can get a total of 20 points, and those categories are criminal/serial killer, character development/character arcs, forensics and context, script writing, and background characters.
And we are in no way, shape, or form associated with Criminal Minds or anything therein. We just are big fans, so don't sue us.
Don't sue us.
So this episode opens and we see a guy leaving a like kind of corner convenience store, and we see that he's bought some ice. He goes back to his van, he smacks that ice down and stabs it open with a knife and pours it into a cooler. We also see him put some other like suspicious stuff maybe into the ice box, and then he drives away in his spooky ooey little van. And now we know that he's probably up to no good. We see him park and get out of the van. He's like on the top of a like garage, I guess, and he's watching people through binoculars. Gross. Creepy.
I've totally never done that. What are you talking about? I definitely don't bring those on every trip I go on and like peek into people's apartments in different cities, just hoping and praying that I catch them having sex. That's not
me. God. I think the last time I held a pair of binoculars was when I was a kid and they were bright and yellow and plastic and for children.
We call them knocks, those in the know.
So the camera shifts and we see two young women who are presumably walking home, and he's watching them. He like runs in. This part is a little weird. He's in the staircase of this garage and he encounters them and they're going opposite directions, and there's like this awkwardness as they all like acknowledge each other and then go off their separate directions. And then they're walking up the staircase and they're chatting, and I guess after they passed him, he like doubled back somehow. Anyways, the point is that when they get onto the floor where their car is, he is already on that floor and kind of just, like, jumps out at them and then just slashes one of the girl's throats with a knife and kills her. And the other girl tries to fight him off for a moment, and that doesn't last long either, and she is also skewered. Don't exactly know how the movement happened in that, but we're just gonna blow past it, so...
I mean, he probably just, like, went up to the next floor and took the I don't know.
A better podcaster would have gone back and rewatched that moment, but I didn't.
Well, he could have just gone up to whatever floor he was going to, and there's probably another stairwell, and he could have just, like, run over to there and then, like, gone down the other side quickly. I mean, there are ways that it was possible, but it is a little confusing, yes.
Back at the BAU. Well, no, sorry, not at the BAU. It's outside, and we see Morgan getting coffee with Tamara Barnes.
You know, I wanted to thank you again for coming to the hearing. I didn't know if it was fair to ask.
Tamara, I'm glad I could be there for you.
I think that the only time that I have felt sane at all in the past few weeks is when I've talked to you.
Really? I feel like I'm the one who's been doing all the talking, man. You've helped me reconnect to my job, to myself, really.
So, listen, I know that your new job is a lot of responsibility and you're gonna have to commit 100%, and you should. But maybe when things calm down, I'll buy you a drink. Fair?
Yeah, it's more than fair.
And she's like, well, you know, well, maybe once everything has settled down with the case and your promotion, we can get a drink sometime. Then she gives him a necklace that her brother used to have. It is a silver necklace with a cross. And she's like, it was William's, but you should have it. I'm like, this feels weird.
Yeah.
Anyways, back at the BAU, Garcia is asking the rest of the team if they know, like, what the actual reason Hotch is stepping down is. We also see Strauss there, you know, the Strauss who I hate. And she is there and asking Morgan if he and JJ have picked a case yet.
So, did anyone explain why Hotch is stepping down?
Well, Morgan said this morning that it's happening.
So we're just supposed to move forward without any discussion?
After Foyette, I think you just have to be ready for anything.
Did you pick a case?
Agent Giroux and I reviewed the request this morning, and I've decided in Oklahoma City.
Why this one?
Locals have more evidentiary information than other priorities. This one, they have nothing. They need us the most.
Good.
If that's all, I'd like to gather the team.
I'll be checking in. I expect to be briefed.
Yes, ma'am.
If you need privacy, please use my office.
That's okay. We're done here.
And when we get back, I'll clear everything out. It'll be all yours.
Hotch, I don't want your office.
I agree with Agent Hotchner. The team leader needs a proper office.
All due respect, Ms. Strauss, but both of you have trusted me to step in as acting unit chief. I'm asking that you respect my decision. I've decided that I don't want Hotch's office. That's where he belongs. If necessary, we can discuss this again at a later date, but right now, we really need to get started on this case.
Now in the conference room, JJ briefs the team on the case that she and Morgan picked. So it shows the pictures that we saw of the girls killed, and she informs them that their bodies were found 2 nights ago in a parking garage.
This is Megan Chertow and her friend Bina Sucarto, both 17, found 2 nights ago in a parking garage, carotid severed. This is John O'Haron, 61. He was found dead in a wooded area 4 days ago, blunt force trauma to the head.
Different MO.
And completely different victimology.
How are the cases linked?
Their eyes have been removed.
Oh, he's an enucleator.
There's a name for this?
It's a rare subset of criminal behavior, but there have been case studies of assault of enucleators.
The overwhelming majority of them suffer from diagnosed mental disorders.
And they're usually males, lack social skills, their kills are disorganized and sloppy.
The typical enucleator gouges the eyes out, but he doesn't normally take them with him.
This guy did?
We need to figure out why.
So Reed is like, oh, yeah, an enucleator. Mate, yeah, we all know what that is, Reed, don't we? And then Hotch explains that an enucleator is a rare subset of criminal behavior. A lot of them suffer from diagnosed mental disorders, and they're usually men who lack social skills, and their kills are usually disorganized and sloppy. So in this case, there is an interesting shift given that he went from killing in a secluded area to then killing in like a public place. And he escalated from one victim to two. So now we're back on the BAU jet.
Hey, girl.
They go on to talk about how the first murder of John O'Hearn seems more personal because it was blunt force trauma. He disposed of the body. The second murders of the two girls seemed very opportunistic because it wasn't personal at all. And he didn't even dump the bodies. He just left them there. So Morgan starts assigning everyone with different tasks, but then JJ steps in and says that the girls' families have requested to speak with their team leader, and it's very awkward. Like, you can tell, like, it just feels like, you know, our team leader, who is Morgan now. They've landed in Oklahoma City, and Hotch and Reed meet with Phil Branton, who is the Oklahoma City detective. And Garcia calls and tells them that she has not been able to find any incidents from the area that also deal with eyes. So this is either someone who has never done this before until now, or just got out of an institution or something like that. They speculate what he is doing with the eyes, and Hotch is like, he is collecting them. However, Reed goes on about how eyes do not keep well since they are 80% water, and after a couple of hours they will, quote, wilt.
Ugh.
I don't want to hear about wilting eyeballs. He then also talks about how there have been cases before where the unsubs have consumed the eyeballs. So the scene cuts, and we now see our unsub eating a hard-boiled egg, and it's a really close-up shot that's made it to look like as if for a second we're like, oh no, he's eating the eyes, but he's not. So he also holds the fork, very weird, and also, what kind of animal eats a hard-boiled egg with a fork? Next, we see him put his unfinished hard-boiled eggs into the fridge next to where he's keeping the eyes.
It is very Vincent from The Big Wheel with the sandwich.
I know, that's all I was thinking. When he saran wrapped himself and I was in the stratosphere.
When he uses the biggest fucking knife ever to cut the littlest sandwich.
So now we see JJ and Morgan meeting with the sister of one of the girls who was murdered.
Thank you for coming here. It's no problem. We can't leave our house. We have to mourn for 3 days.
Buddhist rituals?
Yes.
Did your sister call you while she was out last night?
No. I knew something was wrong. She always comes home by curfew.
Does this man look familiar to you?
No. Why do you ask?
We believe he and your sister were killed by the same person.
It helps us to rule out any connection between the victims, and it tells us that your sister was most likely attacked at random.
I asked to speak to you because we need you to do something for us.
It's okay. Take your time.
Grandma said she saw Bina's ghost last night. Her eyes were just big black holes. Bina was looking for her eyes. She says Bina's cursed. She can't rest. She's stuck for eternity looking for her eyes. We want to cremate her. But we need all of her. Can you find her eyes for us?
We will try. But realistically, we may not be able to.
So back at the Oklahoma City police station, we learn that John O'Hearn, the man who was murdered, was last seen at a bar without any incident. We also learn that the area that his body was dumped in was a remote farm road, and it's the kind of road in place that only people who know about would know, like, exists. Like, you don't just stumble upon that area. So they need to get a list of people who live or work in that area.
Can I just butt in and say, like, they've already identified that this kill with John was a personal one? why aren't they focusing more on the personal motive and like immediately going and like looking at like who he knows and who he interacted with in the last days of his life? That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it seems like they're very like, well, what are the connection like between the two of these? Like, Morgan, get it together.
Oh, I love Morgan. I love him so much.
I love Morgan too. I'm joking.
I know.
All right. So Rossi expresses he has a bad feeling about this unsub. I feel like Rossi does this every episode. He goes, don't feel good about this.
I don't feel too good about this.
He was waiting for the right victims to come in the right time in the right place. All of it was strategic. A lot more organized than that of our typical enucleator. But then Phil comes in and says he got a call from the medical examiner and there is something they need to see. So they zoom over to the morgue and the medical examiner talks to Reed about how the eyes are held in the eye sockets with like six different tissues and nerves. She's like, looking at these photos of John, his eyes were ripped out, probably by hand. However, Bina's eye sockets are smooth on the inside. There's no bruising or sign of trauma. So what that means is that they were surgically cut out. Precise work. So crude with the first victim, surgical with the next. So he's definitely keeping the eyes.
It's almost like that first kill was a mistake and he tried to get the eyes, but because he wasn't practiced because it was his first kill and it was unexpected and personal, it drives me crazy. Why are they not focusing more? Why are they not screaming from the rafters about this? Eventually they catch up to my brains and brilliance, but bro, what the fuck?
So next we see three people out for a jog. A fourth is straggling behind them. Listen, I like exercising. I think it's great. But why on God's green earth would you go jogging in the middle of the night? Bitch, why are you jogging at night? And the fourth girl falls behind. The other three just keep their jogging up. And then she's jogging and then she trips over a tripwire. And I'm like, a wire? Again, this is in the middle of the night? In the woods? So then, of course, our unsub goes over, slashes her neck, and drives her away. And then we see him walk away with his little ice box. Because, again, she chose to go jogging in the middle of the night in the woods.
Listen, what if she was jogging while the sun set and it had just barely gotten dark?
Sometimes these writers, I swear, they're like, how about he has a tripwire? So anyways, the next morning, the BAU investigates. Morgan talks about how the unsub hid in the trees and waited.
He must have hidden in these trees, lying in wait again.
So he picked his location and then waited for a victim of opportunity.
He blitzes her because he lacks the social skills to charm.
That feels like the same pattern as the girls in the parking lot.
But he was quiet in the parking lot. If he hid in these trees, there's too much dry brush, he would have made noise.
No, it's too sloppy for him.
She was a serious jogger. If she'd heard him, she might have been able to outrun him.
Unless he surprised her some other way.
What is that?
Tripwire?
We need to look at her ankles.
He used the tripwire to get her off her feet. She's stunned and she doesn't have time to run away.
He laid a trap for her.
All this plus the way he bleeds her at the neck. It's the behavior of a game hunter.
So Morgan points out how this is the behavior of a game hunter. Back at the station, JJ talks about how game hunting is a big part of this city's culture. And they're also frustrated because guys like this are generally more sloppy and unravel fast, whereas their unsub is getting more and more careful and more precise and more specific with each one of his kills.
He's like evolving instead of devolving.
Now we see Morgan giving the profile, and it's also cut between shots of JJ giving a little press conference.
We believe that the unsub knew his first victim, yet the rest were random. why did we not just focus on this victim? Why didn't we do this? Oh, we could have saved Tripwire Park Girl. Oh, God. I'm going to continue. Most enucleators have a mental disorder and are frenzied and sloppy when they attack. This one has more control. We are not calling him by any nickname. He is just a guy that the FBI is trying to apprehend. He lays in wait for his victims, and he knows how to cut them so they bleed out. This indicates that he might have a hunting background. The FBI is urging citizens to be hypervigilant at night. He is killing in different areas of the city in public spaces. His large kill zone could be related to some kind of travel pattern in his life, which indicates a comfort with these neighborhoods. The escalation could be caused by a self-imposed timeline. He is acting in a delusion that is fueling his murder spree. We believe he is a white male, 27 to 35, and believe he is driving a van or a pickup truck with a removable cab. Something utilitarian that can get bloody and wash out easily. He may have applied for hunting licenses. He has some sort of medical or surgical training, but fell short of making a career out of it. He may have been in a halfway house or been granted leave from a treatment facility. Maybe his family moved him away, but now he is back. He kills at night, employs hunting tactics, and he is patient. He will wait until he can be alone with his victims.
And now we see the unsub watching a couple being gross on the bench at night. The unsub is a little ways away in the park.
They're just hanging out on the bench. There's not even, like, heavy petting.
They were talking about, like, work or something, and I was just like...
Oh, how gross of them. How dare they?
Yeah, disgusting. So, they're just being... It's so, like...
They're existing.
They're existing, and it's so, like, the writers being like, we need to establish that fact that they have a history with each other. And just like, okay. So the unsub is a little ways away, and somehow he, like, gets out of the car, and he is walking, and he, like, fucks with, like, the power box that all of the, like, lamps in the park are lit with. The boyfriend decides to be, like, a genius and is like, hello, hello, like, calling out to him. And the girlfriend, Sandy, is like, not about it. And she's like, no, Wes, we should just go. So they start leaving and try to hide, but it's super dark and they keep talking. The boyfriend is really valiant. He, like, gives her his car keys and is like, go run down the hill to the car. However, while she is running, she falls, of course, and then we hear some slashing noises, and Wes is definitely a goner. And she probably is, too, since she stays on the ground calling out for him instead of getting up and driving away. So the unsub approaches her, and then we see that he has fucking night vision goggles on.
Night vision king.
The next morning at the police station, Rossi visits Morgan, and Morgan is starting to also unravel a bit. He is really frustrated. They haven't had any movement in the case. While this is happening, Phil, our Oklahoma City cop detective, comes in and tells them about the couple that was killed. At the crime scene, they see that he had cut the lights in the park, and Prentice immediately is like, he has some kind of night vision aid.
He cut the wires and electrical boxes, killed all the lights.
So they couldn't see. He wanted to force them off the trail so he could hunt them in the dark.
If they couldn't see, he couldn't.
He probably used some kind of night vision aid, like a scope, something a hunter would use.
Her carotid was severed, and her eyes are missing just like the others.
He didn't take the boy's eyes.
Well, why not? What's so different?
There's a laceration on his left eye, the right eye he didn't even touch.
He's got defensive wounds on his arms. He probably tried to fight back to protect the girl. During the fight, the unsub could have cut his eye.
We said he might be collecting them. What if he needs a set? An injury like that ruins the collection.
The trophies, oh my God.
So he suggests taxidermy. It's because they would have to be in perfect condition, and that's why he's taking the pairs of the eyes.
But it also would show that the Unsub has a skill with hunting because he taxidermies, and skill with anatomy because he taxidermies. Like, everything is lining up.
Yeah, so Garcia calls and says that John, the first victim, had recently written a huge check for Lloyd's Wild Game Shop. This shop is only a couple miles from where his body was dumped. But the strange thing here is that Lloyd died 4 weeks ago.
Does Lloyd have a record?
Lloyd Bulford has one recent record from the city, and it is a death certificate. He died 4 weeks ago.
Of what?
Emphysema.
Any employees with criminal records?
He's got no employment records at all.
He has a 28-year-old son named Earl who lives with him, who has a petty crime record and 3 counts of animal cruelty.
Garcia, get everything on the son.
We now cut and see Earl, the son, at this, like, game shop. We see that he's working on the eye of a deer. And the phone rings, and it goes to a voicemail immediately, and we hear this voicemail from a bank. And now we can see a flashback of the first victim, John O'Hearn, telling Earl that the eyes aren't right, and he can't do eyes right. So his natural, as anyone's natural response would be, is to just grab an ashtray and hit him over the head with it.
Well, canonically, this guy has mental illness.
Ambiguous mental illness. Unspecified mental illness.
But also, I do love the voicemail from the bank, because they're like, we're foreclosing on your house. You gotta get out of there, girl.
As the team zoomies over to this taxidermy shop, Prentice asks about any record of mental illness. There isn't, however. His mother had a degenerative eye disease, and she died when he was 8 years old. So the BAU swarms this taxidermy shop, however, it is seemingly empty. They also notice some specimens of these taxidermy creatures don't have eyes, but then they find one that does, and it has human eyes, specifically John O'Hearn's eyes.
It is terrifying.
It's very uncomfortable.
Oh my god, what is it? It's like some sort of, like, I don't know, like...
It looks like an animatronic. We see that Earl has been hunting since he was a kid, and after being expelled from school, he never went back, so he was very socially isolated. The BAU finds an address book on the counter of the shop, and basically what they're able to determine is that he is dropping the goods off, like different pieces, at homes, and then he is basically sticking around in the neighborhood, like, slash area of where that sale was made, and hunting for victims there. So they find his van, which was registered to his father, in another area. And so they're like, okay, he has to be in this area since he's not in the van. This one girl is walking at night. So she's walking under some scaffolding, and he just, like, grabs her from under the scaffolding. However, they do struggle, and she is able to mace him in the face. Hotch hears the struggle taking place because she yells for help and goes running after them. Hotch gets to tackle him. Hotch gets to be the one to tackle him, not Morgan. It must not be in his contract for this episode.
The roles have been reversed.
Oh, how the tables turn. Hotch apprehends him, and he's getting ready, like, right as Earl is getting ready to remove her eyes. Like, he's has the, like, tools in place. He's about to do surgery out in the open, like, just right there.
Yeah, it also is a little odd because, like, in previous kills, we know that Earl killed the people first and then removed their eyes.
She's still alive.
She's still alive.
Unless he thought she was dead, who knows. Now we see Morgan return to Bina's sister and tells her that they did find her eyes and she can have them back. She just has to go to the morgue to do so. So back at headquarters, Garcia and Morgan are like, why is Hotch still here? He isn't even writing reports up anymore. Garcia notices the necklace that was given to Morgan and she comments on it. However, he doesn't tell her like what it is or disclose the significance of it.
What's that? I haven't seen it before.
Penelope, there's a lot of my stuff that you haven't seen before.
Wow, you're a tease.
What are we doing in Hall's office?
It's kind of not Hall's office anymore. It's your office.
What?
JJ made some calls. Agent Hall's retiring in a month, but he's finishing his caseload at home. So while you all were away, Mama set to work clearing out the rest of his boxes and setting up an Uber office fit for our acting unit chief.
Kirsten, this is for real?
It's kind of blah for my taste, but I figured you need to keep up with agency standards. I did make you your own secret fun zone.
Woman, you have lost your mind, but you are the best.
I completely agree.
And she's like, it lacks some personality now, but I did have a drawer of fun stuff. So he opened it and there's like photos of her and other like sweet, fun things for him. And it's really nice.
Yeah, and it's nice because Hotch doesn't have to lose his office.
And then we also see that the reason Hotch is still there is because he's just driving himself crazy over Foyette still. And now we see Morgan call Tamara and be like, does that offer for that drink still stand? That, my friends, is the end of the episode.
Oh, shit. Y'all want to hear about some fucking taxidermy?
Oh, God, yeah.
Taxidermy is the art of preserving an animal's body via mounting or stuffing for the purpose of display or study. Animals are often, but not always, portrayed in a lifelike state. The word taxidermy describes the process of preserving the animal, but the word is also used to describe the end product. And the word taxidermy is derived from Greek words taxis and derma. Taxis means arrangement and derma means skin. So the word taxidermy translates to literally the arrangement of skin. So, because I texted Abigail and I was like, should I talk about human taxidermy? And she was like, fuck yeah, you should. So there are very few cases of this, thank God, but they were all done on people of color. So I want to read about two cases. This one, I don't feel comfortable saying the actual title of what it's called. I'm just going to say that because it's got a really racist, outdated term that we don't use. But it was a controversial piece of taxidermy of a San individual who used to be a major attraction in the Darter Museum of Banyales, which is in Catalonia. In 1830, the Virax brothers stuffed the corpse of a member of the San, which is an indigenous hunter-gatherer culture that was one of the first cultures of southern Africa. Analysis of the teeth showed that the man was approximately 27 years old. In 1916, he was acquired by the Darter Museum. The body remained in the museum without controversy until the 29th of October, 1991. In 1997, the issue was repeatedly discussed by both the UN and Organization of African Unity. Later in March of that year, the body was removed from the Darter Museum. It was described in El Mundo as a relic of colonialism, but many people from Banyales and the surrounding area were unhappy with his removal because the San was seen as, quote, a member of the community. Botswana's government offered to aid the OAU to bury this man once all his remains were returned to Africa. And in 2000, after the loincloth, feathered headdress and spear he had worn in Banyales was removed, the skull and remaining bones were sent to Botswana in a coffin and they arrived in October. He was buried and his gravesite was declared a national monument. It took them 170 years to realize that this is awful and to return him back to his homeland. Okay, so there's that one, and let's do another one. So this is Julia Pastrana. She was a performer and singer during the 19th century who had hypertrichosis. I don't know how to say that, but that's where there's an overgrowth of hair on your body.
Oh, interesting.
An indigenous woman from Mexico born in 1834. She was born with a genetic condition. Her face and body were covered with straight black hair. Francisco Sepulveda, a customs official, purchased Pastrana and brought her to the United States. At first, she performed under management of J.W. Beach at his circus, but in 1854, she eloped with Theodore Lent and married him in Baltimore, Maryland. Lent took over her management, and they toured throughout U.S. and Europe. Pastrana was advertised as a hybrid between an animal and a human and worked in sideshows and freak shows under the stage names Baboon Lady, Dog-Faced Woman, Hairy Woman, Ape-Faced Woman, The Ape Woman, The Bear Woman, The Nondescript. During a tour, she gave birth to a son with features similar to her own. However, he only survived 3 days, and she died of postpartum complications 5 days later. This is where I'm just shot into the stratosphere. After her death, her husband sold her body and their son's body to the Moscow University, who permanently preserved them. And for over 100 years, the body of Pastrana and her son were displayed in the worlds of museums, circuses, and amusement parks. They appeared in Norway in 1922 and toured the U.S. as late as 1972. And on August 2nd, 2012, it was reported that Pastrana would finally be buried in Mexico. In February 2013, with the help of the Sinaloa state governor, New York-based visual artist Laura Anderson Barbada, Norwegian authorities, and others, the body was finally turned over and her burial was planned. Hundreds of people attended her Catholic funeral, and her remains were buried in the cemetery near her birthplace.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. She spent 153 years basically on display, just saying.
That's terrible.
Anyways, we should rate this episode.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about the criminal / serial killer?
I want to know what his mental disorder was. Outside of just being, I guess, socially isolated. But they said enucleators always have a mental disorder, so...
Yeah, I mean, he definitely had some stuff going on. I did like that he was very accomplished. You know, he had a lot going on. He had a lot of different hobbies.
Yeah, I liked it. I've seen people on like Reddit and other things be like, "Oh, this is such a scary episode." It didn't scare me, but I think taxidermy was an interesting way to take this, and I think the eyes is very, very impactful.
I think he should get a higher score, even though he's not fully fleshed out, because I stan him.
Yeah, what do you think?
Like a 15, 17?
Let's do a 17.
Okay.
Character development, character arc. So we get to see a lot of the Hotch Morgan stuff.
And Garcia, like, really showing Morgan some love. I love their friendship. I think, again, this is not the best episode in the world, but I think this has to get a 20. And then him and Tamara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Forensics and context. The tripwire, really.
Yes. Sent you into orbit. Also, like, it wasn't, like, fully fleshed out.
No. Yeah. Why did they not look into John O'Hearn?
That could be a script writing thing too, though. I mean, we could give both forensics and context and script writing 10s.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay.
And then background characters. Didn't really have a ton.
The one thing I did like, which I guess you didn't like, you weren't crazy about it, but I liked the couple in the park because they put up a fight. I liked that the other girl put up a fight. I did like the sister, and like I liked how they reminded us that we're not all like little Catholic, Protestant, Baptist, you know, whatever. Like there's other religions, and like, you know.
I kind of liked Phil.
15, 17?
Yeah, let's do 17 just to shake things up. 74.
Guys, we have a little surprise next episode. We did book the Unsub is a White Man podcast to come join us. We booked them. Hopefully we don't fuck it up. They're going to join us for the next episode, which you all know is wild. It's the performer. And if you didn't know, we have a submission form so you can submit your thoughts, questions, comments, things you like about Criminal Minds, things we got wrong about the episode that you want to share. And you can follow us on Subs Podcast everywhere. And you can follow me, yournewapartment.tumblr.com.
And you can follow me at Between Stage and Screen Podcasts on Instagram and all streaming services.
Well, peace out, you guys.
Peace out.
Bye.